I met Roger in 2005 at Rameshji's satsangs. And he came every 3 months from Australia. I think till Ramesh passed. That was the pull to the teaching. And initially, one could see Roger getting into deep discussions with Ramesh. And slowly, slowly over time, integrating what he saw was a beautiful expression of the non-dualistic teaching of Advaita. And that is how we met, right from his first trip in 2005. That is when we met, and we kept meeting. And what is interesting is, I was asking him yesterday about the first time he came. He planned to come just for one day because he was moved by Nisargadatta Maharaj's book, I Am That, and he just wanted to pay respects to someone from the lineage. And that day happened to be the day of the floods, and his flight got cancelled. So his next flight was scheduled 10 days later. So the only thing for him to do was come back to satsang. And I have seen that this is the mystery of life. We plan all that we can, but something else happens. And to be open to the divine plan rather than complain and criticize, when that happens, such amazing things unfold. And so we stayed in touch way beyond dear Guru's passing, which was in 2009. And Roger himself has given satsangs across the world, sharing his insights on the teaching. And so, in that spirit, I have requested him to be present with us, share whatever he wishes to, and if you all would like to ask him anything, you all are most welcome to.
So, thank you, Gautam, for the invitation. Gautam was speaking about how in the West the notion of the guru can be overlooked and that the process is sometimes simplified down to a point that a lot of the preciousness is lost. And so I have an ambitious plan over the next little while to try and present my experience as a framework, and that is to integrate the top-down teaching that Nisargadatta puts forward that had a huge impact in the early part of my seeking, along with Ramana Maharshi's teaching. And A Course in Miracles, Wei Wu Wei, Lao Tzu, many of which were looking at the non-dual aspect of life. And simultaneously try and wrap in the bottom-up approach that Ramesh, in the latter part of his life and the teaching, not just a few years, for the last, let's say, 15 years of the teaching, would put forward a bottom-up, a daily living approach to non-duality. And if that daily living approach is heard by someone who is familiar with the top-down teachings, they could easily mistake it as being not at all non-duality teaching. Not at all an Advaita teaching. But in fact, it is Advaita from the perspective of daily living, which will include dualistic explanations in it. But there is a very important part at the beginning of the teaching, the framework that Ramesh used to put forward, that wraps up Advaita in a few sentences. And he would include that at the beginning, but then very quickly transitioned on to the daily living aspect. But it was included, in my view, for very good reason. And that is because the non-dual recognition is important. It is, you can't have one side of the coin only. But his focus wasn't on that, but rather the practical daily living. So let's see if I succeed. But if I do, if it does come across well, then you can, if it's recorded, you can listen to it 1, 2, 10 times, 15 times, 20 times. There's no problem in listening to something many times in order for it to be integrated and understood, to really know what is being presented. Beyond the initial interpretation, it will go through a filter the first time, and it's probably unlikely to be interpreted the way it is intended to be presented. But so listening over and over can be very valuable. So in the first visits, I'll give you two anecdotes that sum up the process with Ramesh. In the first visit, after the first satsang, I saw the devotees lining up in order to prostrate. And even though I had been extremely moved by teachings to the point where understandings had set in beyond the intellect, where there is a recognition that it is, life is much more mysterious than we give it credit for. When I saw the devotees lining up and prostrating, I sort of couldn't help thinking that I think a lot of these people are quite lost, and that what are they doing bowing at the feet of this man? And I did have the thought, you won't catch me doing that. And in the second satsang, which, as Gautam pointed out, was life bringing about a new plan, because I had only intended to be there for one satsang, Ramesh said something to me in a talk that for the next 24 hours circled me like a arrow. It actually felt like an arrow circling. And at some point, I was contemplating what was said. What was said is not important because, well, it's just not so important. And at some point, it felt like the arrow stopped in front of me. And once the particular thought arose, that culminated the contemplation, it felt like the arrow penetrated deep into me. And after that, that evening, that night, there were all sorts of energetic movements happening. And the next day's satsang was filled with a magical feel. The bhajans felt like they were being sung for me. And I saw the body stand up and join the line. I was observing, because I didn't understand the protocol, how people would bow down. And then it came to my turn. And I knelt at his feet and bowed down. And as I touched his feet, everything went black and the body started weeping. And there was complete silence inside. There was an awareness of the body weeping, but it seemed to be out in the distance. And Ramesh started speaking, and after a period of time, I got up and things returned to normal. But it was very evident to me at that point that Ramesh had acted as a catalyst for something that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for his understanding, his pointings, and a far, far greater energy and power that exists beyond us as individuals. And so 20 years on, it feels appropriate and special to try and integrate the two teachings. I was asked a question, and it is a very pertinent way to start. What is the reason for so much of the suffering and ignorance in humanity? And there's many answers to that question, all of which are interconnected and interrelated, but an answer can be presented from many different angles. And the angle that I feel is appropriate for this integrating of the two sides is to say that the world, the experience of life, has been taken to be a three-dimensional time and space objective reality, meaning there is a deep presupposition, meaning an unquestioned assessment that the world that we live in is a world of form, three-dimensional form that extends in the fourth dimension of time. And that is a mistake. And from that mistake, a whole series of consequences happen. Now, if the alternative, or the suggested alternative, is life is an appearance in consciousness, that form is not primary, the fundamental essence of life is not material objectiveness. The fundamental essence is subjectiveness or consciousness. And form is secondary. However, the experience itself doesn't seem to confirm that. The experience of life, when we look at the experience, confirms or implies that form is the nature of this world that we live in. And because of that fact, I wouldn't expect humanity as a whole to consider life to be anything different to that. It is because the way of it is because of the experience of form, of space, and of time, that the essence is taken to be material. And if I were to suggest otherwise, I would expect someone to say, listen, it's pretty obvious that the world is a world of form. And I'm open to that not being the case, but someone needs to present me with some fairly good evidence of that. if I'm going to change my mind. When we look a bit deeper, we might realize, oh, it's not as obvious as it seems. What we know that we have at any moment is a subjective experience. A material world is a cold, dead world. The world of physics is a world where there is no qualia, no sound, no color, no sight. There are waves, sound waves, light waves, or different frequency waves, but there is no experience in the material world. The normal view is that consciousness somehow, unexplainedly, has come out of cold, dead matter. It is an unsolved mystery in science. And I think the fact that what we have as life is a subjective experience has been overlooked, because most people haven't inquired into the nature of their experience. So any scientist that has come up with any theory has done so by being aware of the subjective nature of life. It happens to be a subjective experience that presents itself to be a subjective experience of form, but we've never experienced matter. What has been experienced is subjectivity and experience. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes. So let's consider a dream at night. We're very fortunate, and I don't think it's an accident, that life has introduced night dreams as part of the experience. A night dream spontaneously arises in mind. The night dream is an experience of three-dimensional objects in time and space with a main character. And within a night dream, if a scientist, the main character was a scientist, they would carry out measurements. And if the dream was designed to be a dream that unfolded with consistency, then their patterns would exist and formulas could be derived based on the measurements that are seen on the instruments in the night dream. If you were to go and suggest, if a character in the dream went up to the main character and suggested, do you realize this is all an experience in consciousness, an experience of form and time and space, and yet that is an illusion. The underlying nature of this world that we are in, that is being experienced, we're talking about the night dream here and the character in the night dream, is all consciousness, imagination in the mind of Source. The mystics have been telling us this for thousands of years. In the Hindu tradition, the mistaking the world as a world of form is Maya. The arising of the world in consciousness is called Layla, the play of consciousness. And from the top-down awakening point of view, self-realization or enlightenment is the direct knowing that what we are in essence is formless awareness in which the whole experience, the whole manifestation arises and is made of and is witnessed by that one consciousness, all there is, source. And so the human being goes through life having only ever had subjective experience, mistaking that for evidence of a material world, which in fact there is no evidence of. The assumption is there is a material world that the experience is a representation of. But in the night dream spontaneously arises, and there is no material world out there that it is a representation of.
In the dream, there's a material world in the, sorry, I'm interrupting.
That's okay. Yeah. In the dream,
no material world in the dream, out there, you said, in the dream.
That's right. From the perspective of the dream character, if looking at a dream as a thought experiment, when we look at a dream, we understand that a dream spontaneously arises in mind. The dream is a dream of life on earth, often. And it is not an experience that is the experience of an actual world of form. It arises independent of a material world. And from within the dream, or looking at a dream, we can see all there is consciousness, mind. And the mind, we can say, is synonymous with consciousness. Mind imagines into existence a world. And in the same way, if we consider that what we may be living in is an experience in consciousness, an experience in the mind of God, and the realization that we can have is that what we are in essence, what all there is consciousness. And what we are in essence is that consciousness. That is the top-down explanation of awakening and self-realization. The realization that we are not a body, we are not a three-dimensional object in a three-dimensional world, but rather we are the formless awareness in which the whole experience arises and from where the experience is witnessed. There is not a witnesser of the experience, but rather the whole experience arises in awareness, is not separate from awareness and is witnessed by awareness. It is undoubtedly a very particular creation that has come about, a creation of life on earth, of myself as a particular human being and others. And so this is where we can then start to describe the non-dual understanding from a bottom-up perspective, which means to not transcend the experience, but to describe it from this understanding perspective. So in Ramesh's teaching, at the beginning, he would say that consciousness at rest, pure potentiality, absolute nothing, but not dead nothing, potential nothing. And because it is potential nothing and not dead nothing, at some point it must actualize. It must turn into everything. Everything being the present moment, the experience of life. And so consciousness at rest, spontaneously becomes consciousness in movement. And at some point when the expression has exhausted itself, consciousness in movement will return back to consciousness at rest. Still not dead nothing, pure creative potentiality ready to manifest as a new creation. So that would be the beginning of the talks. It is the inclusion of the notion that all there is source. And the nature of source is pure mind or consciousness. It doesn't create by creating something outside of itself, but rather it becomes the manifestation. The many exist as the appearance of the single manifestation. The me and the other is the one source expressing itself as this particular story of life. We look at the story of life and we can say it is a story of source forgetting itself, experiencing something it can never actually be, separate, disconnected. And at some point, the story in life is a story of source remembering its true nature and suffering coming to an end, suffering being an inevitability in the creation when the hypnosis, the divine hypnosis, is happening. And the forgetting oneself takes the form of identifying as the body, identifying as a three-dimensional object, an object that has thoughts and therefore they are my thoughts, has feelings and emotions and therefore they are my feelings and emotions. And the identification, you could look at it as identification of the mind in which everything is arising, the universal mind or awareness, consciousness, becoming identified with an object within itself that it has brought into existence. Just like in the night dream, spontaneously the world of the night dream comes into existence. A three-dimensional human body is created, and the consciousness of the mind in which the dream is happening identifies with a particular body and experiences life through that body-mind organism as personal consciousness. However, the character in the dream has the deeply ingrained belief, because of the way the experience is created, that I am a separate, independent, autonomous entity with complete volition, that I am in control of my destiny and the other is in control of their destiny. Whereas in fact, the whole dream is unfolding according to God's will, or the will of the source, in this case, the mind in which the dream is arising. And a character that is presented with the idea that, you know, this is all a dream and you are not the doer of your thoughts, you are not the doer of your actions, will say, I don't know what you're talking about. I am the one that is speaking and I am the one that is choosing to move my hands this way. And from outside, it is very clear that that main character or any of the characters in the dream are only have existence because they are part of the mind. And the thoughts that they have, the words that they speak, the movements that they make, the behaviors, the personality, the reactions to what happens in the dream, is all a result of Source, not their own individual volition. And when you look at a dream that way, you can see that it is all a play of consciousness, that the dream will unfold exactly as it's destined to unfold, the characters will interact with each other exactly as is destined, according to God's will, or God for the character is the source of the manifestation, its source that it is not separate from. It would not necessarily recognize this unless it is destiny as part of the creation for that recognition to happen. And so for as long as the dream is set to unfold where the character is unaware of the nature of what to it is life, then it will have thoughts of me and the other as separate autonomous entities. So Ramesh would say that because from within the dream, if there are certain patterns that are consistent, we can then start to describe things from that level. So we can talk about causality. So Ramesh would say that each human being in each moment will function according to the circumstance that they find themselves in and their particular makeup in that moment, and their particular makeup down to the smallest details is a result of their genes and up-to-date conditioning, two factors that were never in our control. A sperm and egg come together. There is a genetic program in there, and the embryo forms and grows according to the instruction, the DNA instruction. And we're not in control of the blueprint and the growing of the body. And so that is the genes bringing about the biological instrument. And that biological instrument doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in an environment that is continually affecting the organism. And so that is the up-to-date conditioning. So a lot of what exists in the environment are the beliefs of society and family and friends and the country that we grow up in, the circumstances that you find yourself in. All of that is new conditioning in the moment that becomes part of one's up-to-date conditioning. And so the human being is a bit like a very complex chemical that has come about as a result of these two factors that it's never been in control of. And it's like two chemicals come together and there will be a reaction. But it isn't up to the chemicals to decide what the reaction will be. It will be according to their characteristics and how they interact with each other. And so Ramesh would use the example of four people in a taxi going through the streets of Mumbai, and they come to a traffic light, and suddenly they are swamped by a group of beggars, and one person has an angry reaction with the hands coming into the car asking for money. Another is fascinated by the scenario. A third one is afraid. And the fourth remains unaffected and tranquil. And so Ramesh would say, there are four different biological reactions to a circumstance that they found themselves in. And each of the four have their own response or reaction according to their particular design. It is not that the one that remained calm or the one that is fascinated is better than the one that got angry or the one that was afraid. They each had the response that they were destined to have, either according to God's will, the dream, if you want to look at it from a generic top perspective, it is just because that is how it has been created to happen in that moment, down to the smallest of details. Or we can explain it in a more causal, practical perspective that might be easier for the intellect to understand or to say, I can work with this. So Ramesh would say there's no third factor or fourth factor. You have the circumstance with all of its complexity. It is what it is. And you have the human being with their particular makeup, which is a result of their genes and up-to-date conditioning. And in the next moment, new conditioning comes in. And that new conditioning will become part of our up-to-date conditioning. We're not in control of how and what effect it has. New conditioning can come in, and the particular body-mind organism, not because we choose to, but because of its particular structure, may be largely unaffected by the information. Or information comes in and it can radically change things. So in each moment, at this point, we are a result of our genes and our up-to-date conditioning. And that is the notion of non-doership, that whatever happens is a happening according to God's will. Or if you want to look at it, Ramesh would say God's will or cosmic law, and didn't specify what cosmic law is, but you could look at it as part of the cosmic law. Could be laws of physics, or in this case we're talking about the very simple, we don't need to be geneticists to understand the principle. There is a biological instrument that grew from something and we didn't control its growth, and it is continually being impacted, and it is one way, this way, in the moment. And the response is a consequence of its design. And the notion that, oh, I should have or could have acted differently, the other should have or could have acted differently, is simply a misunderstanding of how life comes about. If we overlook that we are one way and that the response, the reaction, is according to our design, then the notion of I could have or I should have acted differently makes sense. But when you look at the calculator, you don't say that it should have come up with a different answer, because we understand it can't come up with a different answer, because it is simply outputting the consequence of its design. And a recognition of this, Ramesh would say, can lead to the dropping of a load of guilt and shame, blame and hatred that we've carried for a lifetime. What happened was destined to happen. In a particular moment, the experience will either be pleasurable or painful. The flow of life from the beginning of the day to the end of the day is always on the level of the flow of life, only ever pleasure or pain, somewhere in between the spectrum of extreme pleasure and extreme pain. It is pleasurable if the circumstance is in line with our biological preferences, and it is painful if the circumstance is not in line with our biological preferences. That's the explanation. So these are just pointers, they're concepts. They are descriptions. They're not beliefs, they're suggested so that they become part of the intellect, God willing. And then they serve as signposts and a framework in which a personal investigation of your own can happen. Meaning, look at what happens throughout the day and see if the concepts hold water. And if the concepts hold water, we can put a tick next to them. And as you put a tick next to the concepts, hopefully the framework becomes more complete in your system. And as we investigate for ourselves, it goes deeper and deeper into the system until at some point it can be what we call total understanding, where it has essentially uprooted all of the misunderstandings, the ignorance, which is the belief in personal doership. I am the doer and the other is the doer. And as we go through life and we realize in this moment I functioned a particular way and that the idea I could have done it differently doesn't make sense. And the same with the other. It might not be what we like, which means they functioned in a way that is painful to us because the output of their functioning, what happens in the moment is not in line with our preferences. And so that is the pain. And the perspective of non-doership to that is it was destiny for me to experience pain in this moment. And it was the destiny of that pain, or it was the destiny of the other to be the instrument through which my destined pain was delivered. So they are just the mechanism by which what is destined will unfold. And so we need to ask a question: what are we really looking for in life? And this comes on to the second part of the dynamic that is deeply ingrained as part of our identification with the body, that is also very significant in the arising of suffering, and that is attachment to outcomes. So far we've really spoken about personal doership, the belief that I am the doer is seeing myself as a separate independent entity, and seeing the other as a separate independent entity that is in control of what I think, feel, say, and do. And therefore, if the other hurts me, we say, you hurt me, so I hate you, are the words that Ramesh would use. You should have chosen to be nice rather than to hurt me. And so this load of hatred towards the other gets set in place on the basis of seeing myself as the doer and therefore seeing the other as the doer. And if I do something that hurts the other, then I have to hate myself. It wasn't my intention to hurt the other, but I did. So I wasn't good enough, essentially, is what we come up with. And that is the basis of shame. Guilt and shame. And then pride is the same principle of personal doership applied to the actions that happen through us that deliver positive outcomes. And so then, look what I have achieved. Look what I, as the doer, have achieved. Now, it doesn't look on the surface like pride is a form of suffering. But when we really start feeling into these things, we'll find that pride is just like guilt and blame and uncomfortableness with oneself. And that's why there's the saying that pride comes before the pride comes before the fall. Because if we have the attitude of personal doership, which allows pride to flower, it's not going to be long before life delivers an outcome that we become embarrassed about or shameful about. And the higher that the pride has lifted us, the bigger the fall. So Ramesh would pose the question. He'd say, before we do any seeking, we should ask this question: what am I really looking for in life? Now, it's understood that if the seeker answers that from their understanding, they're likely to come up with something in the flow of life, an outcome. I'm looking for a soulmate. I'm looking for financial security. I'm looking for the world to be a peaceful place, for the other to not deliver pain. But that really is the notion that I'm looking for happiness out there in the future, in the form of an outcome. And that is the ignorance, that is the movement towards pleasure and an aversion to pain. And remember that the flow of life is always going to be a mix of sometimes pleasure and sometimes pain. And the quicker we understand that life is a bit like, we could use the metaphor of an avalanche coming down a mountain, and imagine where they're going, can you move a little bit to the left, please, to the avalanche? It's not interested in what I want. That is the impersonal movement of life, and it is going to be sometimes pleasure and sometimes pain. And so the psychological self that knows itself only as the body is convinced that its happiness is going to come in the flow of life, when life is finally pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And so Ramesh says, no, if we ask this question, the answer to the question, whether we realize it or not, is we're looking for happiness. And he would go further and say, and what is the happiness that is available on a continuous, unbroken basis? The happiness that's available is happiness through peace of mind, and not happiness through pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And what is this peace of mind? We might think, oh, peace of mind is a peaceful feeling. More specifically, no, that's not it. Peace of mind, more accurately described, is in its negation form. Peace of mind is the absence of suffering. The falling away of this guilt and blame and pride, worry and anxiety, disappointment and expectation. And what is this suffering? What is the nature of this suffering that can fall away? And when it falls away, is peace of mind? When we look at the suffering, we see that the suffering is not circumstantial. Circumstance is what is happening in the moment, and that is the flow of life. Circumstance. And circumstantial things are always either pleasure or pain, whether it is in line with our preference or not. When we look deeply, we see that the suffering is this additional layer, which is always attitudinal to circumstance. And what is the attitude that leads to the suffering, the uncomfortableness with oneself, which is not the pleasure and pain of the circumstance? It is an attitude of personal doership and attachment to outcome. So we see that if, when something happens, and the pain or pleasure is delivered. There is this additional attitude to the circumstance, which really means interpretation of the circumstance. And if that interpretation is the interpretation of you are the doer, you hurt me, you delivered pain, so I hate you, then that is blame arising. And similarly, the attitude of personal doership, if my actions delivered an outcome that is painful, I look at my actions and say, oh, I am the doer, I should have done it differently, the outcome should have been different. And so then there is this load of guilt and shame on top of the failed outcome. We've spoken about pride, same principle. So the attitude of personal doership towards the circumstance manifests as guilt, blame, and pride. And the other half of the attitudinal problem is the attitude that we can call the attitude of attachment to outcome. The deeply ingrained assumption that my happiness is to be found in pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And that's why we're seeking out there in the future, one day when things are perfect or much better than they are now, I will be happy. And that essentially, when you look at it, means that there is a dissatisfaction with the present moment, a stating it as inadequate, not good enough. And that attitude of attachment to outcome, meaning that I feel that what I am is added to by pleasure and taken away by pain. That is the identity that is locked away inside the system. If that is the identity, it is a very fragile identity, an identity that is going to be continually attacked essentially by the flow of life. Because it feels like it is dependent on things working out. When we look at this identity, the roots of which are this belief in personal doership and attachment to outcome, we see it as a conceptual identity, an idea of who I am, based on this identification with the body and no connection to the formless consciousness that is functioning through each of us. So that attitude of attachment to outcome, which is part of the identity, it has to be the way we relate to life if the identity is being set in place in a particular way, and that is a result of large part the up-to-date conditioning. Then we're bound to experience the form of suffering that we can call anxiety, worrying that the future is not going to turn out, and expectation, where we are continually imagining what will one day be sufficient for my happiness. And if we're lucky in life, we get what we want, and we realize it hasn't delivered happiness. We just find ourselves setting another goal. And so these concepts, not meant to be beliefs, but as we investigate, we'll start to see, oh yes, there is an attitude of attachment to outcome. There is an attitude that my happiness is to be found in the future, in pleasures. And then when we see the guilt and the blame, we can see that there is an attitude to the flow of life, to the circumstance that is superimposing this false idea that we are all functioning according to our will, rather than a recognition that life is a happening according to God's will. And as the understanding starts to become part of the working mind, which is the functional part of the intellect, and Ramesh would say, make no mistake, satsang is simply new conditioning that can become part of your up-to-date conditioning. And if it does, you'll find yourself walking through life. You don't have to put an hour aside every day and mark it in your pie chart of life spirituality. The understanding and the personal investigation can happen as you are going through life and you stub your toe and the thought comes up, pain in the moment. You receive a text from someone who says, oh, I can't pick you up in half an hour, like I said, as you've got your bags packed waiting to go to the airport, for example. And once again, pain in the moment, and you might find yourself aware of the blame that arises on top of the unfortunate circumstance. So the suffering is not necessarily going to end, but we might start to find ourselves in a position of witnessing the thinking as a happening, watching it from a perspective that it can be seen as not my thinking, but rather thinking happening. The objectifying of even feelings and emotions, thoughts, is the movement from the notion that they are my thoughts, my emotions, my feelings, to the recognition that they are an arising in a biological instrument, a biological robot, Ramesh would say. They arise exactly as they are destined to arise based on the design in each moment. And so then there's a part of the system that can take them less personally. And involvement or identification is the movement where things are taken personally. So no one is doing it wrong, even when there is the strong belief in personal doership. That is destiny imposed by consciousness in order for it to experience itself in that way for a period of time. Time is also not a reality, but a construct as part of the experience of life. The realizations that happen often in a way that reveals that time is not fundamental, that what we are in our essence is formless, eternal, which really means timeless. And prior to space. Space is a construct that happens, that arises within the consciousness. Now, this consciousness can become aware of itself. So as the belief in personal doership and attachment to outcome, as that identity starts to loosen up, a witnessing consciousness starts to present itself as the true subject of this moment. And that consciousness can see the body as just an object moving within the present moment experience. So there is value carrying out certain exercises where we come to the present moment, drop ideas of here and there. You know, we are convinced that there is a New York and a France out there. If you come to the present moment, you find there is just this experience. And this experience is known by awareness. At first, it seems like it's known by the body and the senses, the sense organs. And when that is the experience, then that intensifies the experience, I am the body, and it intensifies the beliefs, I am separate, independent, autonomous, I am the doer. It intensifies the deeply ingrained beliefs, I am dependent on pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. That's the best that the body can imagine, because it is part of the flow of life. As the bondage of that identity starts to weaken because of an investigation, we might find ourselves able to close our eyes and experience silence. And in that silence, we might realize that the world of form has vanished to a large extent, that the background of consciousness or awareness continues to be there, but that the visual objects have fallen away. And if we can start to question some of the deeply ingrained beliefs, such as a here and a there, such as the notion that awareness requires a body, then our meditation experience goes deeper, starts to reveal the nature of consciousness as fundamental and the nature of experience as secondary. The meditation can start to reveal that the experience is not separate from consciousness. At first, the witnessing creates a separation where the objects are felt to be separate from the witnessing awareness. And at some point, it becomes apparent that what I am is not separate from the world. Now, this doesn't mean that we end up living as consciousness. But in my experience, the awakening is what allows us to come to know the essence of what we are. And in knowing ourselves as formless awareness, it starts to become more obvious that, oh, happiness is not to be found in outcomes. Awareness, formless awareness, is unaffected by what arises inside of it. Grounding into the beingness starts to give us our own experience, a self-affirming notion of contentment, self-contentment, the peace that surpassed understanding. It's not because of something, but rather it is what we are. It is the natural state. So as the thinking mind starts to merge or dissolve as it drops into the heart of being, then the suffering is seen to be an additional interpretation of life. And that is why peace on a continuous, unbroken basis is available. Because once the seeds of the narrative of suffering start to die, then the suffering falls away. And that is what allows a dropping from the thinking mind into our own being to be there. And that's where we start to realize that understanding and knowledge are not something that get put into textbooks, but rather it's a knowing or an understanding of the true nature of who we are. And peace is an indivisible aspect of that. Ramesh would describe the human being as the impersonal consciousness of source linked to a particular body-mind organism and functioning through that body-mind organism as personal consciousness. Personal consciousness, in my interpretation, is the experience that is being had in this present moment from the perspective of the individual. The understanding, however, is that that is a personal perspective that Source is having by linking to a particular body-mind organism and experiencing the experience of life from that perspective. And continuous unbroken peace of mind comes from the continuous unbroken recognition that we are always connected to Source. That we are Source, that we are the awareness functioning through the body-mind organism. So understanding that I can't do anything unless it is God's will is the understanding I am always connected to Source. We can never be independent. We sometimes in society there is this striving to be independent. And ironically, freedom comes from the recognition that we are an instrument through which Source functions. And if that recognition remains constant, we can say, I am always connected to Source, and even the language connected changes in our mind. It's like, I'm not separate from Source. I am not different from Source. I am Source having a human experience. Ramesh would also say everything that has been said in this moment or at any point during time is only a concept. It is not the truth. The only truth in the manifestation is the impersonal sense of I am. So the concepts are pointers. They are descriptions. They might at times sound like prescriptions, but the understanding is there is no one to do anything. And so even the notion where we might hear abide in I am, which would be an instruction that Nisargadatta, or a concept that Nisargadatta would put forward, that which he received from his guru. It sounds like an instruction. You must abide in I am. But actually it's a description of something that may happen as part of the unfolding of life. It might happen if life brings about sufficient precursors for that to then be something that happens. So the notion that everything is a concept is here so that the relationship hopefully becomes a healthy relationship to what the concepts are pointing at, so they can be investigated, but ultimately to realize that peace is not to be found in a continual thinking about life, but a dropping into being, and that is what I believe the impersonal sense of I am that Ramesh was referring to is. Ramana said, use this thorn to remove the thorn embedded in your thumb, and then be sure to throw both thorns away. And so the thorn refers to a concept. The thorn embedded in the thumb refers to a belief. That is a concept that has been taken to be truth. And so we can use one concept to uproot a concept that has become ingrained as a belief. Brahmana, knowing that what we will do at first is replace one belief with another belief, has warned us to be sure to throw both thorns away. Because the understanding is essentially beyond the concept. So, with that being said, if anyone has any questions, Gautam or I, we're happy to.
So, is this on? I don't know. It's on. So, just to backtrack from the practical to the top-down part which you started with. Source is all there is, and source has this world, the material world, including humans, all of us, are an expression of source, you could say. Is source a different form or an expression? A different version of source. The world and people is my words. I don't know if I'm choosing the right words, but
say source in expression.
In expression, right. And then somewhere later you also said that when there's too much suffering, or did I mix up, that this dissolves and then again re-expresses itself. Like you could say maybe in a dream. Yeah? So what is the point? Basically, so, of all these, like dramas, life, source expressing this world and all of us, and we, you very beautifully, towards the second half, talked about managing life, the practicality and suffering and avoiding that and knowing that it's all destined and so on. So source is just having fun or just... For what is all this? So, I mean, I've often heard Vedant lectures and all on YouTube as well. And this is a question that I've always wondered about, if you have any.
Well, from the point of resting and being, the question just doesn't arise. From the point of knowing oneself as that in which it all arises, it is self-evident, and the question of why doesn't arise. So we can know that the question why is actually a question that the ego asks. Often the ego is, because it is convinced that happiness is to be found in outcomes, it's the purpose is to get somewhere, to win. And if we talk about life just happening, that entity says, well, in that case, what's the point? Because the capacity to win has sort of been pulled out from underneath it. And it makes sense. But if we can see that that is because the question is coming from a presupposition, essentially. And so from the point of consciousness, the act of creating is its nature.
Is it nature?
Basically, the source was too bored to be alone.
That's,
there's no fun.
That's
so, in order to discover how boring it was, because nothing was happening, it created multiplicity and then suffering, so as to rediscover its innate sense of peace. That's how the human mind would figure out why the source created all our suffering.
So, source witnesses itself also is possible, because if there is only source, how does source witness source itself? If you're aware, that's another question actually.
That's a beautiful question. I mean, my understanding is awareness, unaware of itself as awareness, because there's only one, is aware of itself as I am, I exist. awareness which is unaware of itself as an awareness, because there's nothing else, can only become aware of itself as being.
Minute you say I am, that is ego, that is identity. No,
see, Ramesh would give a beautiful example that if your memory was wiped out, if someone pressed a button and told you, look, you're going to forget all your memories, your name, everything, you will still be left with one thing. And that is the impersonal awareness of being. That is not the ego. That is beingness, because you are aware that you exist. That is what he was referring to. You don't know who you exist as, because the memory is gone. Would you like to add to that?
No, I that's exactly right. Even if memory is still there, in a particular moment, it can, in effect, not be there because it's not manifesting as anything. And if you are in meditation, the body sense also falls away. And so what one finds is that if destiny is not superimposing a residual sense of self, a residual sense of the body, and thoughts have fallen away, memory has fallen away, there might be this realization, I exist, I am. And what exists in that moment is simply the formless, spaceless space that is aware and is aware of its own existence. It is undeniable. So if the question was posed in that space, are you dead? Not from thought, from the actual undeniable sense of existence, which is inherent in consciousness, in movement. There is a recognition, I am, but as Gautam beautifully said, what I am is undefined, but I am. And so it doesn't even require the body in my experience. And yet we have to continue to live for as long as the world continues to, as if...
Through the motions of this life and this world.
Yeah. But no, at some point we can find ourselves doing in each moment what needs to be done, understanding that all of that is happening according to God's will, with a connection to the formless aspect of self. That means... in each moment, I can drop into that and see, oh, I am. I haven't changed, even though I've missed my plane. I am. And so then there is a great freedom from the flow of life. And so really from that place, the question of what for, it doesn't arise.
Thank you.
I had a question which is related, actually. I don't know if the answer is any different, but if you look at the expression of consciousness, and you know, it hits pretty hard in a country like India, in a developing country where millions upon millions of people don't even have basic dignity of life. Why is the expression so lopsided, where the first noble truth has to be that suffering is the most elemental thing in this expression? The thinking mind does ask that question very often. Why couldn't have been a utopian world where the body did not have to age? A lot of suffering comes from there. You know, people had resources. The world wasn't tough.
That probably exists somewhere in the multiplicity of creation. This manifestation is a manifestation of duality. And so the interconnected opposites have to be part of the manifestation. So Ramesh would say health, disease, wealth, poverty, big, small, good, bad. And so to see the unfolding of life as the unfolding of a story of duality then renders those questions also irrelevant. So why did God have to produce the handicapped child? Ramesh's answer, because he produced created the healthy child. And that is something that a perspective that comes in as the attachment to outcome weakens, because the identity that knows itself as limited and physical and dependent on outcome simply can't accept that duality, the two arms of duality are valid. So if you find someone who's very traumatized by a certain type of abuse, their whole system is wired to try and bring life into the position where there is none of that and all of safety. And so it makes complete sense if we look at it as an inevitability. That's how it has to happen. As that identity starts to change and starts to weaken, starts to dissolve, in this case, I would say, through the personal investigation of your own life experience, in line with the concept, such that the understanding goes deeper and deeper, God willing, then the witnessing of the good and the bad as the whole is something that can come into play. And so when we look at the yin-yang symbol, it is the one half is black, the other half is white, and yet the whole is the combination of the black and the white. And so, yeah.
What is your name?
Karthik.
Yeah. So, Karthik, this is called in our tradition the Mrityu Lok, which is the realm of death. So, by nature, it is bound to be one of not utopia but suffering, because we are learning through death. So, as Ramana Maharshi said, largely those on the spiritual path, if not the first blow, then the second. If not the second, then the third. Finally, they come onto this path of inquiry, what is life about? So it is suffering which brings about this inquiry. When the Buddha realized after he left the palace that actually life is about suffering, then his journey began. And of course, in India, the population is large and largely poor. So you see much more suffering than in a developed economy, no doubt. But you have the concern for this question. Someone in Norway may not even think about it, because their environment has shown no poverty to them, for example. Actually, we in India are blessed, because it is seeing suffering which is igniting the spiritual inquiry. You know, I am astounded that being in Sobo, the kind of suffering I have seen, God has been kind to put me in a nice home and make me suffer. Because the terrorist attacks which took place at the Trident, at the Oberoi, were 5 minutes away. So he said, don't worry, I won't inconvenience you, I'll put you right there. So may you may suffer in comfort. You see, because I've written about that incident and how our friends were killed in that terrorist attack. So it is the realm of suffering to learn. We are fortunate that we are not suffering so much that we are below the poverty line, where we are just concerned with food, shelter and clothing. We have enough where we inquire and ask, why are we suffering? What is suffering? And where can I find my peace? Through the suffering. Yes, sir.
In 2 days, I went for 3 funerals. And some family was close to me. I knew there was so much pain, everything. I was there for more than the time, for the whole time of the funeral. And I was thinking, observing everything and all. And what we study here and try and understand, can somebody achieve? See, because somebody is in pain, you want to heal them, you want to be compassionate to them and all. But the role of not getting affected is not easy, because you are playing a part in the living of life every day. So how can somebody achieve that, remain unattached absolutely and be a part, play a part? But how do you differentiate that and how do you achieve that, number one?
But why do you want to achieve that?
You don't need to achieve
that. No, you have to act according to your nature at the funeral. Be yourself. If you're sensitive, if you're sensitive and you are compassionate, certain thoughts, feelings, emotions will arise, and if you're built another way, they may not arise.
It's a part of
it. I feel so. What do you say?
Yeah, the peace of mind is not the absence of sadness. Sadness is a biological emotion. Compassion, you can say, is a biological emotion. The peace of mind is that which lies behind as the attitude to those things. And if the attitude of doership that says, oh, I shouldn't have, or I should have been more compassionate, if that doesn't arise, there is peace of mind. So, you can be as you are.
See, not being attached is everyone's innate knowing is life is transient.
Yeah, that's
that's an innate knowing.
Yeah, because you know that one day you want to go to...
Exactly. Exactly. So, in spite of knowing that, our attachments make us suffer, right? Yeah. But so what? It is not my attachment. Attachment is there. I think, you know, we put an overemphasis on not reacting, being detached, being absolutely still and calm and not showing a flicker of emotion. There's no ideal perfect state of being like this. Otherwise, Ramakrishna would not cry when his nephew died. Or even Ramana Maharshi would not have shed a tear when his friend passed away. But we don't destroy our peace because of the event. Anyone who has to go to two funerals or three close to each other will be shaken up biologically, forget anything else. But you don't mope and mourn and go into depression and tell the world, I went to three funerals, look at what God did to me, how mean God is. That dialogue is finished. You're just dealing... See, you'll have no problem if you receive three invitations to marriages. See how we are. We are happy, right? We'll dress well, go to the marriage, have nice free food. So suffering is really the doorway to discovering our peace. It's beautiful.
But how do you, like his question, was that so much suffering is there?
Yes.
Can, how much one can be helpful?
Sure.
To reduce the suffering of the people.
Sure. All you can do is try to the best way possible. If you are moved to reduce the suffering, you must honor that feeling. Someone else may feel just me sitting at home in peace is my honoring of it. So to each their own.
But let's also be clear, what you can offer is pleasure or pain. So you can offer comfort.
I went for all the natural calamities like earthquake and flood. Being a doctor and having a team of my own, I could immediately, you know, rush and try to be a part of whatever, because the disaster was so much. The government or the state or the local people were not, you know, ready to take care of all that. And we saw so much suffering, the Kutch one, and then I went to the Latur earthquake. And
no, I think it's an amazing thing you all do, really. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful to be so moved by the plight of humanity and have the resources and the feeling to help.
Being blessed to be a doctor and a family.
Yes. At the back, someone wanted to ask a question.
Just before, for the sake of precision, because I feel like the framework requires a precision as it goes into our system. We're so prone to using the word suffering when we are talking about unfortunate circumstance. And I think it's important that the framework separates out pain from suffering. In the framework, suffering is the psychological attitude to what is happening. And so if we start having that clarity, just even with words to start with, it ends up delivering a clarity of what we are able, what we start to feel and be able to be aware of. So I think it's important to use pain and keep suffering to guilt, blame, pride, worry, and expectations.
Roger Gautam, thank you. Roger, you said that in Nisargadatta's I am that, I am is a description. Is my understanding right that it's a description rather than a technique? Because I was thinking that it is a technique. When I'm reading the book, I think that it's a tech. I mean, that is what my, that is what I'm going by, that it's a technique that I should be using to have a realization. Is that not supposed to be a technique? And can you elaborate more on when you, what you mean by that, that it's a description rather than anything else?
Yeah. So I think I used the example abide in I am as a concept that can sound like a prescription, but is in fact a description of what might happen. The doer can't help, and mind you, the whole English language is set up on the basis we are doers. So there are verbs, doing words. And so the doer identity can't help but hear a description and say, oh, in that case, I have to make it happen. Whereas part of the understanding that sets in is to see, I have never made anything happen. Life has always been happening. That it looks like, oh, I built something in the garden. But rather, a movement of life happened such that something in the garden came into existence. And so in this teaching, it says no one has to do anything. Life will bring you, for example, to satsang because an urge will arise. An advert will be seen. Then the urge will arise. And then while in satsang, life will deliver new concepts, new conditioning, and they will become part of your up-to-date conditioning. No one does, you don't have to do the understanding or the misunderstanding, should it come about that there's misunderstanding about what's said. That happens. So someone says, so what do I need to do from here? And say, no, nothing, it's been done. And then throughout the day, a thought might arise. The description was life is sometimes pleasure and sometimes pain, a continuous flow of pleasure and pain. That thought is an output of a body-mind organism that now has a particular up-to-date conditioning, not because anyone did it, but because life brought us here through the condition, new conditioning out, became part of the up-to-date conditioning, and then the thought comes up. Life is a flow of sometimes pleasure and sometimes pain. The doership relates to that thought and says, oh, I did that thought, not recognizing it was a happening according to the body's genes and up-to-date conditioning, including the new conditioning that came in from satsang. So Nisargadatta would put concepts out there about abiding in I am, for example, what that means, dropping out of the thinking mind, for example, and dropping into the heart of where an impersonal witnessing can happen. And so the descriptions become part of the conditioning, and then we might find a dropping into the heart happen. And the prompt might be in a moment when there is awareness that suffering is happening. All of the understanding that has set in place because of the new conditioning might lead to a thought arising that says, I am. Now, the thought I am is not the impersonal I am-ness. It is not the abiding in I am. But it can be the bookend to the thinking that is going on in that moment. And in that I am, there is a lot of understanding, including, for example, this thought doesn't need to be completed even. This thought is just suffering. It's obscuring my peace of mind. All of that doesn't have to happen. It's built into I am. So I am might start coming up as a prompt that acts as a bookend to the thinking and also becomes part of the shift of gear into arresting in the present moment. And somewhere Nisargadatta said, my guru, Siddharameshwar Maharaj, said, abide in I am. Nisargadatta was a bhakti. He trusted in the guru, obeyed the guru, and he said, after 4 years, self-realization happened. Now, abiding in I am doesn't mean you will fall into I am and then for 4 years remain in that I am-ness. It means the thought I am, or whatever other thought for someone else, it might be stop, comes up when there is a recognition that suffering thinking is happening. And we drop into being, and it might last for a second because the pull of the thinking mind is so strong. And you won't even notice that I am-ness lasted for half a second. And then 10 minutes later, the recognition of the thinking mind is there again. And the thought I am can come up and drop into being for another half a second. And if that goes on for 4 years, and that might mean just drop into I am twice in a day. There could be a week where it's completely forgotten and then a remembrance happens. That movement starts to... if it starts to happen, so it's not a prescription to a doer to do this practice ardently as the doer, because if that happens, then the doer is remaining in place. And dropping into the heart is not compatible with the presence of a doer. The dropping to heart is a recognition life is happening, where there is nothing to do except witness the flow of life. And so if that becomes a practiceless practice, a happening, the path between the head and the heart gets strengthened, a bit like a jungle, and you have a machete and you're cutting through a path for the first time. And as it's walked more and more, it becomes more familiar, easier to get through. And so this drop into being becomes effortless. But it can take some practice before, and that yet that practice is something that has to happen, not something that the individual does. But there's no reason why it won't happen, given this is the pool that is being swum in.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay. Roger always makes a lot of sense. I don't have the bandwidth he has to explain these concepts. It's really, I'm amazed at the depth with, really deep dive into stuff, yeah. I'm a shallow diver. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Do you get affected when you see such mass scale destruction, when you go to volunteer with your team? Does it affect you?
I feel the pain.
I'm sure.
At times nature has not been good to them.
Sure. Sure.
But what I can do, I will do.
Right. So that does not hamper your work while you're there.
No, I'm a doctor. Right. I have dealt all my 40 years in even with dealing with ICU, putting lines, ventilators, that's my specialty.
So I'd like
I do all the work of organ donation. I do lectures everywhere.
Oh, beautiful.
I must have counseled about 600, 700 patients for liver transplant. I do the family counseling.
That's beautiful work you're doing. It's admirable. So I'll say something on a lighter note. So it dissipates heaviness. So a surgeon entered the operation theater. The patient was lying there, about to receive anesthesia. So the surgeon told the patient, "Don't worry, David. Everything will be okay." So the patient was horrified. He said, "But my name is not David." So the surgeon said, "I know, I'm David." You know, and that's the beauty of life. Some of us are fear-based and fearful. If we just accept that without wanting ourselves to be another way, it becomes so much easier to deal with our fears without the obsession to remove them. Just to accept them, this is how it is. Yet, I go and do my work.
So I have a question, like very basic actually, where you mentioned about like, you know, I'm genetically structured a certain way and I'm conditioned to be a certain way. So that's how I experience my pain and pleasure. While I understand it intellectually, while I'm in the moment, I'm not able to detach with the pain. Or maybe I experience the pain, but I continue to suffer. So how do I drop that attachment and that suffering in that moment?
I'm going to be a bit cheeky because Ramesh used to be cheeky. He says, for the last hour and a half, I've been saying, no one is the doer. There is no doer. And yet, just to demonstrate how deeply ingrained the belief is, the question is, so how do I drop this?
How do I drop the doer?
But having said that, there is a validity to the question and we can answer it in a way that... So your genes and up-to-date conditioning can be separated. We can break it into two sections, the biological aspects and the psychological aspect. Psychological in this case is different to how it might be used in different fields. The psychological aspect is the attitude of personal doership and attitude of attachment to outcome. That too is part of the system, part of your genes and up-to-date conditioning. And so if the system includes that as part of the genes and up-to-date conditioning, there's no question of not getting involved in the pain in the moment. It has to happen because that identity is designed to get involved in the pleasure and pain of the flow of life, to attribute doership to oneself and to the other. So the narrative of blame is going to be there. As the understanding goes deeper and deeper, meaning at first, in the working mind is different to the thinking mind. The thinking mind is associated with this psychological self. So the thinking mind does the blaming and the feeling guilt and the pride. The working mind, on the other hand, is functional and it's practical and it's intellect. The other is intellect as well, but it's intellect in the form of belief of personal doership, and the working mind is intellect that can start to investigate a concept. And so as that investigating of the working mind happens, especially when there is no suffering being triggered, because when there is suffering, the system is too involved in that. There's no space for... So earnestness to me, something that Nisargadatta says is essential if a seeker is earnest. Once again, not an instruction to the seeker to be earnest, but a description of a particular seeker's makeup. It means the seeker will be continually interested in this, not just when things are going wrong. And so in the flow of life, an investigation of the concepts can happen. The understanding becomes deeper and deeper, meaning there's a section inside the system now that is a counterbalance to the psychological self. And that means that the involvement of the psychological self will get cut off quicker than it would previously. And it also means that the involvement of the psychological self might be less intense. So Ramesh would say that at first the suffering would happen and it would be at the count of 10, not 1, 2, 3, but a unit of 10 before it gets cut off. And as the understanding goes deeper, it might then start getting cut off at 7, at 3, at 1. And when the understanding is total, the psychological self has been completely uprooted from the system, so the seed is not there anymore and the psychological suffering won't arise. So it will get, another way of saying it, it gets cut off before it even arises.
So, Roger, in your case, was it the same way? Was it like a linear progression where the psychological suffering was getting cut off slowly, slowly? Or was it like just all at once?
I came from the top-down teaching first, where there were these awakening experiences. It was very energetic. And so when I came to Ramesh, one of the first interactions we had was, because I was describing life from the non-dual awareness perspective. And Ramesh said, so who's speaking to whom? And my answer was, well, consciousness is speaking with consciousness. And it wasn't just a conceptual answer. It was from this place of being aware of life from a position of impersonal awareness. And Ramesh's answer was, Roger, don't be ridiculous. Roger is speaking with Ramesh and Ramesh listens. And then Ramesh speaks and Roger listens. And I hadn't really gone into Ramesh's teaching at that stage. And I couldn't process, because for me the process had been 5 years or so of coming to see there is no Roger and there is no Ramesh, there is just life happening. And so this was very confronting to the understanding. I actually, at some point I thought maybe he doesn't, because it wasn't just a concept to me. It became apparent after a while that he knew exactly what I needed, and that was to come back down to being Roger. And I wasn't even able to acknowledge I am Roger at that stage. I was stuck in this perspective where, because of the process that required me to not acknowledge Roger, in fact to see Roger as unreal, the awakening process teachings do that. It had its effect, but an integration needed to happen. And so Ramesh often says awakening is spontaneous, but deliverance is gradual. And so I think that in my case, there was a practicalness even before the awakening teachings, that if I was there was suffering because of a relationship, there would be an interest in my thinking, and I always knew it's my thinking that is causing the problem. So if I could come up with some reason as to why I'm potentially getting it wrong, like do I really know that this narrative is correct, then that would subside. Then the awakening, then there was more stuff, that in particular this these teachings that really focused on the doership thinking, and so that remaining part of the psychological self needed to be dissolved. It wasn't a particularly hard thing when it follows the awakening perspective, because it becomes self-evident. It's just that the intellect hasn't realized that that is still incompatible, that that sort of thinking is incompatible with a recognition that all there is consciousness. And so there, to me, it's both. There's a gradual and there are spontaneous. And these experiences or awakenings, it's not about the experience itself. I believe something happens in the experience, some reboot, some reset, some dissolution. But it could easily happen while someone's asleep and they have no awareness of it. In my case, I would say that the various revelations of peak experiences played into the sort of intellect seeing what, and then the intellect realizing it has to stop in order for that to be. But I have a very particular process, and it doesn't mean everyone is going to be the same. So from one perspective, there is no time, it's not gradual, it's all spontaneous. But from another perspective, it unfolds over time.
Yeah, I think mine was quite similar, because I felt like awakening had nothing to do with my integration and daily living and peace of mind and all that. Was a different subject altogether. So, well, it can give you a glimpse, and you can really...
Well, as Gautam, there's plenty of people that have had awakenings, and then the suffering aspect doesn't magically dissolve. That's a different, but it's not different as in not related.
Yes.
It is related, but it's another process that has to happen.
Yeah, no, so my question was, don't you think that's necessary to happen to see that nobody is the doer? Because until you've had I don't want to call it an experience, but if you've not had the recognition of that, it's impossible to see that, you know, things are just playing out.
I wouldn't go that far. I think you can intellectually, like philosophy doesn't, only at the end of philosophy, they talk about gnosis, but a lot of philosophy is about rationality and logic. And so you can come to an apperception of there not being a doer without an experiential shift. And that will in itself lead to a weakening of the psychological self. So that's why I think it's important that the teaching doesn't fall foul of critical thinking errors. And there are an explanation, for example, we are functioning according to our genes and up-to-date conditioning, because that is information that can deliver real change. So Ramesh used to say that the top-down perspective is an all-or-nothing proposition. Often there's seekers from the top-down perspective that after 20 years, they're basically where they started. If you take the bottom-up approach, even if enlightenment as a shift in a recognition of self doesn't happen, there's a relative amount of peace of mind that can come in. And that relative amount of peace of mind is, to me, means a significant weakening of the psychological self, which leaves the system prone to an awakening out of the blue at some point that will reveal the nature of consciousness to itself by itself.
Thank you, Roger. I had a question. So wouldn't meditation practice be a doing, or is it dependent on the intention, or I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah, usually meditation starts with a meditator, and when it becomes true meditation, it's because there is no meditator. So hopefully there is guidance from a guru or from a teacher that encourages the meditator to recognize itself as being there, the one that wants the meditation to look a particular way, the one that is disappointed if there is noise outside, if the meditation doesn't go deep enough. And when that is realized, and maybe you have a description that meditation is simply allowing everything to be as it is, or I think Ramesh said meditation is the recognition that everything is an arising in consciousness, then the I want it to be this or that now and not in 3 years' time, when that falls away, that movement, which is not the movement of a doer, it is the movement of the belief of doership. Because there really never has been a doer. There has only been the movement of thoughts that looks, that takes on the belief or the attitude, I am the doer. And so in an instant, the meditator, which is really the doer, can fall away, and then there is simply allowing, the allowing of consciousness, or consciousness allowing the moment to be exactly the way it is. But that is a happening and not something someone does. It's, you know, you will see meditation start off one way, and then with certain insights or prompts from life, it automatically changes to something else.
Y'all can ask Roger questions. He's here, so take advantage of it. I'll just take a rest.
Although I don't have any question.
So
I just wanted to share a poem. Its name is Unfair Trade. Trade. So basically the feeling behind is when a seeker came on the path, on a spiritual path, with achievement of something, you know, getting some experiences or something. And when he get dwell deeper into the path, he start, you know, losing the things, experience the pain of losing. So then he feel, you know, it's an unfair trade, a kind of, you know, resentment towards the guru. And then after, you know, sometime he realizes it's really an unfair trade, because what I really lose is mine, but what I really get is everything. So it starts as, I came with dreams, a longing heart, to reach the height, to play my part. I met my guru, wise and kind, hoping new treasures I would find. Yet with each step along this road, I watched my world grow dark and cold. Relationship, family, work all vanished as I searched more and more. I cried for what I thought was mine. I mourned the loss, the steep decline. What kind of trade, unfair and strange? To lose it all, what did I gain? Yes, later I realized this is truly an unfair trade. For in my hands, the grains of sand have slowly faded. I lost what I call mine in worldly lands. O Guru, by your grace, I found the treasure in my heart. Your love, O Guru, is a sacred flame, burned away all my desires, pride and name. I lost the world, but found its source. My heart dissolved with deep remorse. No longer bound by fleeting things, no cage of name or place or ring, I found the gold, the boundless sea. In losing all, I found the true me. No more I am the one who cries for fleeting joy or passing ties. I bow to you with folded hands, O Guru, the Lord of all lands. So here I stand with empty hands, grateful for your gentle plans. O Guru, who guide me through loss and pain. Through you, I have found my soul again.
Beautiful. From the heart.
Thank you so much for sharing.